Welcome to the Master Your Health podcast, your top resource for all things nutrition, fitness, and health. I'm your host, Amanda Rocchio, and today I'm here with my co-host, the research junkie between the two of us, and my husband, Chris Rocchio.
Hello, everyone. And really quick, here's a review from one of our listeners titled, I Always, and this is from Sherry V8. I always listen to your podcast twice. The first time to get the material and truly hear what you are sharing. The second time is to take notes and to try to incorporate into my daily life. Thank you for the information you're sharing and helping myself and my family become healthier. Every episode has been beneficial, even the ones I thought wouldn't pertain to my family. Keep up the great work. Wow, listening twice, that's quite a compliment.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. And I love how she takes it seriously, trying to incorporate the information into her lifestyle, because I feel like that's a really hard part, because obviously there's tons of good information out there. And of course, we share a lot of good information on this podcast, but we also want you to actually incorporate some of these tips into your life. Not all of them at once. So really think about how you can apply this to your daily life and things you can really do to make these new tips into new habits.
Yeah, absolutely.
And for those listening, if you guys could pause the podcast, leave a review, it'd mean so much to Chris and I. So if you don't follow me on Instagram, Chris and I just moved from LA to Orange County. So we're getting used to the suburbs. So hopefully we'll start incorporating some video on podcast soon. But let me just say, it's a nice change of pace from Los Angeles, a bit of the traffic, you know, a little bit more space for the price. I have to say, I'm definitely ready for suburban life.
I mean, I've become accustomed to the traffic in LA, so I'm kind of desensitized to it. But the space comparison is just unreal.
Chris really put our home gym together, so I'm really liking having the full squat rack in our 3-car garage right now.
It's and not jammed into a little tiny 4x6 patio that we have in a 2-bedroom apartment.
Oh my goodness, that was driving me crazy. And then when I would take some videos on the squat rack, I'd get some comments like, you're gonna hit the window, because it was so close to the window. And I was like, I'm fine, I'm not hitting the window, but I understand where you're coming from.
It's like, not when I got that perfect form.
Anyways, I wanted to get into today's episode, and we're bringing you another myth busting series. So this is part 3. So if you haven't listened to the other two, go back, listen to them. They're really good.
And well, you don't really have to listen. It's not like a continuous series. You don't have to listen to part 1 and 2 to understand part 3. That's the beauty of this series. But you should definitely go back and check those out, because we cover some important ones on those.
Definitely. Yeah, you don't need to listen to the first 2 parts, but let me just say, it's packed with tons of good information, because we kind of bust different myths all over the place, which I find helpful and also good for my attention span, because it's not just like one long thing. So I do really think you'll enjoy those episodes if you haven't already checked them out.
Right.
So starting off today's episode with myth number 1, which is fresh produce is nutritionally superior to frozen produce. So this myth is not as cut and dry as you would think it would be, because it really depends on which fruit or vegetable we're looking at. So for example, a 2017 study published in the Journal of Food Composition and Analysis showed that the beta carotene content, which is a precursor to vitamin A, was higher in fresh broccoli, but lower in fresh corn and fresh peas when compared to the frozen version. So I think that's a really interesting example right off the bat. And there are also so many factors that come into play when you're looking at the nutritional content of fruits and vegetables. So the particular piece of produce, the particular nutrients you're looking at, soil quality, the time period and length from harvesting to final use, growing methods, ripeness when harvested, post-harvest handling, distance transported. So basically, researchers from Harvard concluded that the nutrient content really depends on the decisions and practices all along the food system from seed to table, which is why we do want to start taking a look at how our food is grown and what companies we're buying from, and not just, fresh versus frozen produce, really. So circling back to the 2017 study, they looked at the nutrition content of fresh stored, and frozen produce. So fresh stored actually means produce that's bought from the store and then sitting in the fridge for 5 days. So that's the distinction there. So this study looked at a whole bunch of vitamins and minerals, but taking a look at vitamin C, particularly in broccoli, corn, green peas, and strawberries, Fresh and frozen were about the same, whereas fresh stored scored a little bit worse than fresh and frozen. So that's really interesting to think about. For spinach in particular, it was higher for fresh, but lower for fresh stored and lowest for frozen when it came to vitamin C. But it was actually the opposite for folate because it was more in frozen spinach and then less in both fresh groups.
And that means more nutrient content in this case, not more nutrient loss. So basically the frozen and fresh groups had a higher nutrient content than the fresh stored.
Right. But when you really look at the numbers from this study, the authors also concluded that you'll find that there was almost no significant difference between the different groups. In cases where there was, it was a result of too much storage time. And the authors concluded, quote, "Our findings do not support the common perception that fresh produce is nutritionally superior to frozen produce." So you can obviously see that was their takeaway from this study in particular. And there's other research that supports this, showing that if anything, people underestimate the loss of nutrients from fresh storage. So you don't need to be afraid of frozen produce. In fact, sometimes it can be better, it can be slightly worse, but overall it's insignificant. Really the key factor here is making sure you're getting in enough fruits and vegetables. We don't want you to avoid that. Even if sometimes you have to go for canned green beans, again, getting in some produce is better than not eating your fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, and this is kind of revolutionary for me because I always thought that the best was to go fresh, but then there was always, I mean, not too much, but there's just a little bit of waste maybe at the end of the week if you're a meal prepper or something like that. It may be a lot easier to not waste, but if you're kind of just like putting a whole bunch of stuff in the fridge and then making meals as you go, there could be a possibility of some of that food, you know, growing some mold or going bad, especially if it's fruits or berries, like raspberries go really quickly in our house. And so I just said, screw it. I'm going to stop throwing away fresh raspberries and buying them frozen. That was a game changer years and years ago. So just don't get bogged down on the minute differences of these things. Like Amanda said, it's really just the most important thing is getting this stuff in your body. All right. So moving on to number two is fasted exercise burns more fat. And this one I love debunking for people because, I mean, I've always been a firm believer that you should have something driving your workout. Energy-wise, it's just been my experience with people that I train with, people that I train directly, and myself, that no matter how small or light the breakfast is, even if it's a handful of nuts, I always feel more charged when I have something in my stomach to pull from, or something in my system to pull from, I should say, rather than just going off of a long fast, let's say 10, 12 hours after, you know, waking up and not eating since the night before. But that's all anecdotal, so I'm going to back it up with some research here, and we're going to get through some of the nuance because it's not cut and dry. So to first understand the mechanism behind all of this, you have to understand blood glucose and glycogen just a little bit. So for instance, any glucose in your system that doesn't get burned for energy first gets stored in the muscles and the liver, mostly in the muscles, a little bit in the liver, and that gets stored in the form of glycogen. And then any excess on top of that will be stored in fat cells, the theory says. And in terms of energy burning, your body will tend to pull from the stored carbs rather than mobilized stored fat for energy if it's readily available. It's just more efficient to do that as far as your body's concerned. So it's not just prioritizing burning sugar in the blood, but also from the sugar stores in the muscle. Okay, so the theory about fasted exercise burning more fat came essentially from three points. So number one is insulin levels are low in the morning, and insulin spikes are responsible for suppressing lipolysis. And lipolysis is just that metabolic pathway in which stored fat is released from the fat cell, broken down to isolate the fatty acid, where it can then be transported to cells and burned for energy. So the theory behind this is in the absence of insulin, lipolysis should be uninhibited and allow more fat to be burned during the training session. And this is important because you have to understand that insulin actually suppresses that releasing of the fat from the cell. It has to do with this enzyme called hormone-sensitive lipase and its ability to draw that fat from the cell to be utilized for energy. And insulin suppresses that whole mechanism. So that's the whole thing, is that in the presence of insulin, that's not going to happen. And the second point that this myth is derived from is because glycogen is low in the morning, the body should be more likely to use that stored fat. And this does sound legit because you just came off of at least an 8-hour fast, but it's really not the case unless you're in a ketogenic diet or you're actually fasting, because sleep is not something that deplete your glycogen. I mean, even a hard workout isn't going to fully deplete glycogen. So it's not exactly the case. I mean, the assumption, the mechanism behind it is correct, but the assumption that you're waking up glycogen depleted is a misconception. So you're going to have some glycogen stores from the previous day's meal. So like I said, those are the two main scientific points. And the third one was kind of debunked a long time ago. And that's the idea that you've optimized fat in a specific quote unquote fat burning zone. You may remember the old cardio machines. You go into the gym and it has a little graphic on the front board that says that shows your ideal heart rate that you should be at for fat burning. You know, it has a little graph and like you're in the fat burning zone.
I'm pretty sure they still do that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Right. And this stemmed from the idea that high-intensity workouts were more likely to burn carbs for fuel and that lower-intensity work would draw from fat stores. And this really isn't the case either because researchers found out that high-intensity training was actually more beneficial for fat loss when you factor in the efficiency of the work done. So, I mean, that's a different topic altogether about like the HIIT versus LISS, you know, high-intensity interval training versus low-intensity steady-state cardio. And that can be a different thing that we do, a completely different podcast topic because that's a long drawn out topic. And there is literature to support all of these points, or at least some of the mechanisms that these points are drawn from. Like for instance, the studies that show your body uses much more carbs during a workout if you consume before the workout. And that's pretty intuitive. And also there are studies that show that insulin does suppress lipolysis. So there's validity there. But as always, there's nuance to this because this point kind of like stops the clock at right after the workout. But we still have 22 or 23 more hours to account for throughout the day. And we know that fat loss isn't just about what you're doing in your workout. It's about your caloric net balance over the course of, you know, the entire day, or some people do it throughout the entire week. So it's a much longer time span than just the 1 hour while you're working out. So you will burn more energy, you know, calories from fat in that fasted state than you would if you ate carbs before your workout. But that doesn't mean you'll burn more fat overall throughout the day. Because in the long run, in the studies that show that equal calories were given during both fasted workout days and non-fasted workout days, when the subjects fasted before their workout, they had to make up for those calories after the workout. Because remember, they are equating calories. So they were eating more in the time frame post-workout all the way until sleep. So you're still getting the same energy throughout, you know, the 24-hour period. It's just a matter of when you're burning it and the in your metabolic processes more condensed into that small window, or smaller window, I should say. On the other hand, those who ate before the workout have already burned through some of those calories from before, so they're burning more energy after their workouts and throughout the rest of the day. Another study showed that if you burn more of one type of substrate, which means energy, say carbs versus fat, during a particular cardio session, you'll burn less of that substrate for the rest of the day, which is really interesting and contributes to what we were talking about earlier. And the authors concluded, exercising after breakfast would be more effective than fasted training to lose weight through the increased metabolism and reduced RER in the hours after the training session. And RER refers to respiratory exchange ratio, and it's an indirect way of showing the muscle's oxidative capacity to get energy. So to sum it up, more fat is burned during that 1 hour if you're fasted, but less so for the rest of the day because you're eating more food for the rest of the day. So the conclusion from a couple of these newer studies is that fasted exercise when compared to fed exercise, quote, does not increase the amount of weight loss and fat mass loss. So the people propagating these myths aren't wrong about the mechanisms and the studies they're citing. We want to be clear about that. They're obviously citing research and showing some of the mechanisms behind this. It's just that they are only looking at the acute studies, meaning focusing on short-term changes rather than long-term trials that, you know, take other mechanisms into consideration and investigate the full-scale overall changes in body fat and energy utilization. So the conclusions as to how these acute studies translate into real life are a bit too simplistic, and, you know, they break down if you span that time frame longer. So this is just breaking down the science, but you know, you may actually have a hard time getting yourself into a caloric deficit for fat loss. So maybe the fasting before your workout helps you do that because it squeezes your time frame down for how much you're eating in the day, and you're actually able to stay in that deficit for the rest of the day. More power to you, whatever you need to do to trick yourself. Also, some people just feel bloated, sluggish, may get a little nauseated if you have an intense workout when you eat before. Say you wake up really early and you immediately go into your workout. Nobody wants to eat and then immediately start working out. Say if you have a morning routine and you have to work out before work, obviously we understand this, but, and I'm not telling you not to do it. I'm just saying, don't trick yourself into thinking that that is more efficient for fat loss.
Yeah. I mean, whenever I have an early workout, I can't eat before. It's like really difficult. Or if I do, sometimes it might be a handful of nuts, but if it's like very early, there's probably no way. Like, I'm just so not hungry. Mm-hmm. But I also think it's good news because I do think there are people out there who maybe feel more energized. They literally feel better before eating, before their workout, and they weren't doing that because for some reason they thought fasting was so superior. So for those of you who feel a pretty big difference in performance on your exercise or workouts if you eat before, I think I would definitely go ahead and do that. For me, I don't notice that big a difference if it's a morning workout, for sure.
Yeah, but in terms of fat loss, I'm still not saying that one is superior to the other. I'm not saying it's inferior. I'm just saying it's not superior.
Chris is pretty obsessed about eating before his workout, so that's his bias.
But I also understand the whole idea because we did a podcast on insulin resistance, and I understand like the longer you're going to give yourself a break from spiking insulin and to work on that resistance, and also working out does help improve insulin sensitivity. You're most insulin sensitive directly after a workout. So the more you can stay in that state where you're not spiking insulin will help with that resistance. If you're in that state, say you're pre-diabetic or diabetic, metabolic syndrome, all those things. So it's going to be different for everybody, and they're going to be varying scales. And we'll actually circle back to that idea later when we talk about blood glucose.
So next myth on our list is eating carbs in the evening or before bed makes you fat. So they basically say that you shouldn't eat carbs after 7 p.m. because you're more likely to store those carbs as fat. Well, if that were true, I'd be pretty overweight then.
You and I both. So this comes from two lines of reasoning. One is that metabolism slows down while sleeping. So to understand this, we have to break down a little bit about metabolism and understand at least some of the broad strokes about it. So your base rate of metabolism is called your basal metabolic rate or your resting metabolic rate. And that's pretty much just if you laid in bed all day, how much energy you would burn, how much your cells would need to just maintain the current bodily functions, right? And then on top of that, you have what's called the EAT, the exercise activity thermogenesis. And that's the boost in metabolism you have from your workout during the day or your training. And then you have your non-exercise activity thermogenesis, and that's like fidgeting, walking around throughout the day, things like that. And then you have the thermic effect of meals, which is smaller, but it's still a component. And that's the idea that, like, say, for instance, protein has a specific thermic effect. Carbs have a thermic effect. Fat, they all have one. So that's also a small uptick in metabolism. So those are the four components of your metabolism. But it turns out your metabolism during sleep isn't significantly different than the RMR during waking hours. And there's a study for that to back that up in our show notes. The only exception to that is that your metabolic rate while you're sleeping can be lower than your RMR for obese subjects, but it can actually be higher than the RMR, which is the resting metabolic rate, in non-obese subjects. But these differences were very small and they're still practically the same. So just wanted to throw that out there. So in short, first, eating carbs at night before you settle down is no different than eating carbs at lunch and then going to sit for the rest of the day, like 4 or 5 hours. And second, and this is one of the things that is new research, it's going to be a little bit controversial and kind of flies in the face of some common understanding about the science behind this, but dietary carbs are not as readily converted into body fat as some people think. It's called de novo lipogenesis. So basically, the real mechanism behind it is actually just the carbs inhibiting the freeing of that stored fat to be burned. Like we were talking about before, that lipolysis, that process of freeing that fat. So it's just the fact that the carbs are blocking the ability of the burning of fat and therefore allows for more fat to accumulate. So in more scientific terms, the insulin is suppressing the normal rate of fat oxidation. And basically less fat is freed up for burning, so more fat is going into storage. And just remember that all of this stuff relies more on net caloric balance in a specific time frame. Whether that time frame is 24 hours or a week, it's still going to be the driving factor. Okay, so that's the first misconception that the myth is drawn from. The second misconception is that insulin sensitivity is lower at night. And there's some research to show that you're much more sensitive in the morning than at night, but this can be explained by the difference in fasting windows that preceded the insulin spike. So your first meal of the day is after an 8-hour fast, which you're rarely doing throughout the day to mimic in a later meal. But if you compare insulin sensitivity after a mid-afternoon meal to one at nighttime around 8:30 p.m., there's no significant difference. So we've established that the underlying assumptions are incorrect. In one meta-analysis in 2017, covered over 100 studies and narrowed them down to 5 that met their strict criteria. And their findings debunked this myth and concluded there's no statistically significant change in fat loss if evening meals are reduced.
So again, this is going to be a personal preference and how your schedule plays out and largely what are your net calories for the day. So maybe, you know, not eating at night helps you lower your calories if you're trying to eat in a calorie deficit and lose some weight. Now, this doesn't mean there aren't any benefits to cutting yourself off at a certain hour. So when it comes to syncing your circadian rhythm, eating late at night can affect your sleep. So if you're having crappy sleep, that in itself can affect your weight loss. So that would be more of my question to you. I notice if I eat a bigger meal too late, that'll affect me more. But if I have some carbs, I mean, Chris and I have popcorn some night, maybe some fruit, something lighter, I notice it doesn't affect my sleep and therefore, you know, isn't hindering any weight loss if I was trying to do that. So that's something to consider. But there's also other benefits from eating carbs at night, like an increase in serotonin when you eat some carbs at night. I know Chris just has to cut back on the midnight munchies though. Yeah. He's like a little raccoon in the kitchen. I have an ongoing joke because sometimes he'd get into the chocolate chips and I'd find them like scattered on the counter with some almond butter open. And I'd be like, mm-hmm. Oh, look what the raccoon ate last night.
Oh yeah. The raccoon, he goes for the same thing every night pretty much.
And it's so funny because it's like when you eat at night, you like never put it away. It literally looks like some kind of animal got into our kitchen.
Yeah. Cause I want to be punished. I want you to see that happen. And I want you to bust my balls in the morning. No, go ahead.
But I think this is great news for any of you who were nervous about eating carbs. And remember, not all carbs are created equal, right? Because we hear this word carbohydrates, and whole food carbs are something we've shared more and more that you don't need to be afraid of. Mm-hmm. And it's more of these like highly processed foods that contain maybe a high amount of sugar and carbs that you may want to check just in general.
Right. And there's also some benefit to restricting the window in which you're eating and consuming anything that has a caloric value to it. And some people say that to just basically cut it off at 12 hours, you should be fasting for 12 hours and eating in a 12-hour window. That's the thing that's doable for me, if doable at all, but but that's the goal that I set for myself. All right, so moving on is, and you've been hearing me talk pretty steadily here all the way through, but Amanda's going to follow it up. So if you're tired of my voice, I don't know what to tell you. All right, so number 4 is weight training when young stunts your growth. And this is geared primarily for adolescent athletes. So the myth started from a study in 1964, and I think it was in Japan, when a team of researchers found that children who performed heavy labor tended to be shorter.
Wow.
And they hypothesized that the mechanism behind this was that the excessive weight carried caused damage to the growth plates at the ends of the long bones. But this actually turned out that this is only shown in the case of bone fracture or break, so that's not really the case. And on top of that, this was another issue of correlation versus causation. The communities that were using children to do physical labor were also the ones more likely to be impoverished, so the stunted growth was a result of malnutrition and being overworked rather than from the loads carried. And circling back to the growth plates theory, in 2014, there was an international consensus position statement on youth resistance training that was endorsed by pretty much every relevant and reputable organization you can think of. I mean, we're talking about the NCAA, National Strength and Conditioning Association, and the American Academy of Pediatrics. But there's a long list. There's another dozen or so international organizations that signed on to this. And they stated, quote, "Fears that resistance training would not injure the growth plates of youths are not supported by scientific reports or clinical observations." Okay, so boom, no evidence to support that claim. And they continue, "which indicate the mechanical stress placed on the developing growth plates from resistance exercise or high strain eliciting sports such as gymnastics or weightlifting may be beneficial for bone formation and growth." So it's the exact opposite. And it's funny because this has been around since 1964. Over 50 years later, people are still propagating this myth.
What's the age that they suggest for weight training? Though I do know there is like a certain age where they, before they say add in weights, But I also, it's the difference between adding in weights and resistance training, which is just using your body weight, which I assume you can also do even younger.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. There's really no limit to it. Obviously, you want to start the kids off light and make sure their form is correct. You don't want to immediately have them jump in and just pick up whatever they're strong enough to pick up and all form be damned. But they're not giving any age range right here. I mean, it's specifically adolescents, prepubescent and postpubescent, things like that. But I mean, I've seen people, you know, having their kids do deadlifts, you know, starting at like 5, 6 years old. I'm not saying that you should do that, but there's no literature out there that's telling you that you shouldn't at least be working on these normal, you know, functional movement patterns at even a smaller load than normal body weight. And, you know, like until there's research that comes out, then who am I to tell you you can't do that if you think it's safe and you know your child more than anybody? But don't let some study from 1964 that's been debunked for decades and decades be the one that tells you not. You know your child. You know what they're capable of. You have their best interests at heart more than anybody else. So you be the judge in whether or not they are capable and all the above of doing these resistance exercises.
Absolutely. And we even had a podcast with a PE teacher, and she goes through a lot of the resistance training. She has her, like, I think 15-year-olds doing. So I think it's a...
Yeah, but 15 is still pretty young. I'm talking about, like, you know, 11, 12,
yeah,
maybe even younger. All right, to wrap up this section, another review reported that high loads, which is just the weight used when you're lifting, have a critical role in bone mass acquisition before and during puberty. Boom, that's what we just said, right? So before puberty doesn't mean that you absolutely have to do it after puberty, and they're actually calling it beneficial at this point, not detrimental. So there's no reason to believe that your child's growth is going to be stunted as a result of this. And like we said, quite a bit of evidence to suggest that they are going to benefit from this. And it's also been shown to be good for injury prevention, setting healthy habits early, things like that, you know, trying to instill some discipline in your kid. It's not just for improving musculature.
Absolutely. I think there's some great news here, and we'll buy our kids some toy dumbbells.
It's like that one viral video of the kid, yes, who like power cleans that little plastic thing and then, yes, like throws it down. He's like, ah.
Someone better get that for our kid. That's what I'm saying.
I know.
So last myth on our list is that apple cider vinegar is affected for fat loss and or weight loss. And we also want to look into another claim regarding blood sugar control and apple cider vinegar. So to give you some background on how apple cider vinegar is made, I actually just learned this too. It's actually made from taking apple juice and adding yeast, which ferments the sugars to alcohol. Then you add bacteria that converts the alcohol to acetic acid, which is vinegar. Some people claim that the mother, which refers to the slimy blob that provides the bacteria, provides specific enzymes to aid in digestion and other health benefits. And to our knowledge, there is no study showing that there's any difference between the effects of regular vinegar and apple cider vinegar. Part of the reason for this is that the enzymes in your stomach will just digest any enzymes from the mother, which will nullify their effects, which basically, you know, makes it equal to taking regular vinegar. So because we've established there's really no difference between apple cider vinegar and regular vinegar, we can actually look at the studies on regular vinegar and see the effects and see if the claims hold up. So on the question of fat loss, let's look at some of the research. There was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study, which is the gold standard of studies, on obese Japanese subjects that showed that the two groups who had vinegar every day, and one group had 50 milliliters and one group had 30 milliliters, showed that they had lower body fat and weight changes after 12 weeks when compared to the placebo group. And just to give you some other information on that study, each group did have the same calorie and macro ratio. The researchers from that study concluded that the daily use of vinegar might be useful in the prevention of metabolic syndrome by reducing obesity. And they state this may be because the vinegar inhibits lipogenesis, which is fat storage. So there are a couple reasons to be skeptical of this study. One, all subjects were obese, so it's not really giving us an indication for someone in a different weight group. And when you look at the results, even the high dose group only lost about 4.4 pounds on average over 12 weeks. Also, the study had patients using a diet diary to record their food. So we've discussed this before. That's not really super reliable. Now, another study in 2013 showed that vinegar enhances satiety, but the researchers noted that it was actually giving people nausea, which is definitely not a sustainable strategy. It's like the food poisoning diet. Like, it's not the way to go.
Yeah, I guess that's one way to go about it. I guess you can just make yourself nauseous all day achieve a caloric deficit.
So crazy. Now let's take a look at the research behind blood sugar control in relation to vinegar or apple cider vinegar. A 2017 meta-analysis of 11 studies found a significant effect on both glucose and insulin response in the vinegar group, and five of those groups actually did use apple cider vinegar, not just regular vinegar. The effects were generally larger in people with insulin resistance, like diabetics, pre-diabetes, or obese subjects, so it's going to be less effective for healthy individuals, which is really interesting to think about. It's also important to note that the glucose-controlling effects depends on the types of carbs you're eating. So it does seem to work on starchy, complex carbs, but have no effect if you're eating or drinking simple sugars. And this is because it's actually inhibiting starch digestion, which is super cool. But the sad thing about that is it doesn't really work on things you'd want it to work on, like high sugar food, highly processed food, candy, all that stuff. You know, you're drinking apple cider vinegar shots, and then you're eating this sugar and starch, you know, the starchy carbs it does help with, but the candy, not so much.
Yeah.
Lastly, to go over one other aspect of the myth is that ACV is fermented, so it must have some beneficial probiotics. But the mother colony we talked about earlier is made up of a type of bacteria called Acetobacter, and this strain is not likely to be probiotic according to the research. So again, this is not even really maybe a beneficial probiotic-rich food.
Well, it's not at all.
There you go. So all in all, we'd say the claims around apple cider vinegar are pretty misleading and often a little bit too strong. Even though there is some evidence to suggest there are some benefits, there's no reason to believe that apple cider vinegar in particular is better than normal vinegar. So that's good news here because you can also just incorporate some normal vinegar into your diet, especially if you're insulin resistant or more overweight. And overall, it's an important reminder that a lot of the benefits are seen mostly with obese patients or people who are insulin resistant. So if you're already at a healthy weight, you might not see as much benefit as those other groups. So there you have it. That's our 5 myths for today. I hope you go back and listen to part 1 and part 2 if you want to hear even more myth-busting fun. Chris really worked hard to put together this research, so I hope you can leave this episode with a clearer mind and don't fall for those apple cider vinegar gummies that have sugar added to them. You don't need that in your life. I see celebrities promoting that kind of stuff. Don't waste your money.
Yeah, that's just for the birds.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. We'll catch you guys on the next one. Bye.
Yep. See you.